Some hours later, some aeroplanes flew up the Mersey, and anti-aircraft batteries were given colour codes and a Morse letter which planes were supposed to give when they're flying over English territory. Well, these planes never give any distinguishing colours or Morse letter flashed. So the boys of the Isle of Man battery, a couple of the guns, opened fire. There was panic. It was only a few hours after Chamberlain had declared war. They fired again. Actually, one plane was shot down. And those were the first shots that were fired by a British Army unit in the Second World War. The regiment became famous for it later on. But it was a very difficult time. I remember a few days after I got a letter from Joyce, and she said that she'd gone to church that night, St. George's Church, to pray for everyone, especially me. It really touched my heart. And for a few more weeks, the regiment, we were stationed at the same place, manning the guns and practicing on the guns and keeping a watch for air attacks which were expected but which never came. It was tiresome and monotonous, but with cheerful comradeship we battled the boredom and the monotony. When we were off duty, Pat and I used to go into town together. His girlfriend crossed from the island to be with him, to be near him. In spite of the war, she wanted to carry on with their wedding. Who could blame her? So they made their final preparations. I was lucky enough to get a weekend pass. That was with being at the battery office and helping cook for the officers. That's the reason I got a pass, so did Pat. Anyway, I went home on Friday night and came back on the Tuesday. So on the Saturday, I crossed in the boat and arrived at Douglas at 2:30. That evening, I went to Joyce's house, and I knew her mother would be out. So I met Joyce and we went for a walk on the promenade to the far end and then sat down on a seat. How much there was to talk about. So many things had happened in the last few weeks. It's funny what a difference a parting can make. Before I went away, we were just like good friends. But now, we both felt it was more than just friendship. For Joyce, I thought it was just like puppy love, but for me it was the real thing. However, we met again on the Sunday afternoon and went for another walk along by the Polrose River through to the ferry bridge. And then back along the Peel Road into Douglas. It was a beautiful day, beautiful, sunny, and we really enjoyed our walk together. But I was getting a bit worried about Joyce being so young and then me being away, and I told her I'd been thinking it over, Joyce, and I think it'd be better if you forgot all about me. She says, what on earth for, Bing? So I told her, I said, well, now that the war's starting, we're at war, sooner or later the regiment will go overseas to fight, and I don't want you to worry about me. You're too young. There are a lot of nicer young fellas for you, Joyce. Young fellas 16 or so. So I told her that was it, how I felt. Said, you see what I mean? She just smiled and said that I was only saying that because I didn't want her to worry. She said, but you don't mean it, do you, Bing? She said, I know that I'm only 15 years old, but I feel a lot older. Everybody tells me I'm a lot older than my years. She said, and I understand a lot. I like you very much, Bing. I don't want anybody else. I won't be always 15. Anyway, you're only 4 years older than me, and in a few years' time, that won't matter. So she said, it's no use trying to lie to me. So I said, okay then. I'm sorry, forget I said it, and promised to keep on writing. That night we went to St. George's Church for the Evensong service. It's only a short walk from the church to Joyce's house. And as we were walking along Circular Road, arm in arm, Joyce said, it's been a wonderful day today, Arthur. Just like old times. She said, I go to church every Sunday night since you've been away. I go every Sunday evening. So she said, what do we do tomorrow? It's your last day. So I said, oh, we'll go for a walk. I said, I'll bring the camera. I said, get Mabs and your brother Leslie to come along. And I'll ask Ivor. We'll go up the playing fields and have a game of tennis. And I'll take some photographs to take back with me. So she said, oh, that's fine. So we arranged to meet on the Monday afternoon. In the morning, I went shopping. I bought some kippers at Crellin's Kipper Shop to take back for Pat and me pals. So I was a little taste of Manx kippers, a change from the army diet. I called in the post office to send cheerio to all the chaps I was used to work with and all that. So after dinner, Ivor called for me and we set off down Bucks Road. And I was in my uniform, all polished up, and we met Joyce and Mabs and Leslie, and then we set off walking up to Nobles Park. Leslie had brought a ball with him, and we had a bit of a game of football, then we had a game of tennis. It was great fun. We really enjoyed it. I took some photographs. Time went over far too quick. In the evening, I met Joyce again, and we went to the cinema. First House. I walked home slowly in the blackout. Of course, it was blackout then. The blackout laws had come into being, so there was no street lights. It was very dark and black. So we set off walking for home, and then when we got near the house, we stood in the shop doorway, and I said, well, Joyce, this is where we say so long again. So I had my arm round her. She said, yes, it's awful, this, you go away and me being here with nothing to do. If only I could go away and do something. Sometimes at night I lie in bed and cry. I'm fed up with school. I'm old enough now to go and learn to be a nurse. If I could only start my training, I'd know I was doing something. It gets me down, Bing. Sometimes I wish I was dead. I said, oh, come on, come up with Joyce. Don't talk like that. Be patient. It won't be long before you get your chance to be a nurse. The things we want the most are always the hardest to get, but if you wait long enough, your dreams are sure to come true. Keep on smiling, Joyce. You'll get your chance, I'm sure you will. So she thanked me and said, I'm sorry for saying that. Only I get awful depressed now and again when I think of what's going on at the moment. I must be going in now, she said, so don't forget to write to me often, will you? I look for Ivor every day to see if there's any word from you. Look after yourself, Bing, and I'll be thinking of you all the time. And I told her that I'd be thinking of her and not to forget to keep smiling. I told her I'd write every time I got the chance and said it won't be long together before we're together again. So long, I'll be seeing you. And then I kissed her goodbye and she went in the house. Next morning it was farewell again to Mum and Dad and the rest of the family and set off on the morning boat. It was a pretty good crossing and arrived back at the billet about 3 o'clock. The boys were glad to receive the kippers and we had them for tea. The rumours were going about that the regiment were going to be moved. So everybody was pondering where, were we going abroad or what? But it was the day after I got back from holiday, from me leave, that a funny thing happened. Fred used the dispatch rider and slipped off out of the dock to go and buy some sweets or something. He'd gone to buy something and the Sergeant Major come looking for him. Stanley Clucas, who was a pretty portly gent, he was a bit in the tubby side. And he wasn't so young then, he'd be probably his early 50s, early 50s I would think. So he come round, eventually he come to me, he said, have you seen Fred Hughes, the dispatch rider? So I said, no, he was here a minute ago. So he said, there's an urgent message to go to headquarters. You no idea where he is. So I said, no, I'm sorry, Sergeant Major. He went round, he was asking everybody, and he said, this message has got to go. So he said, is there anybody here that can ride a motorbike? So there was one chap, I forget his name now. I'm not sure his name was Kirkpatrick or not. But he says, I'll try, sir. So he got hold of the bike and he was looking at it and trying to kickstart the thing and he was ages and ages. And then the finished Stanley Clucas said, have you ever ridden a motorbike before? So he said, no, sir. So he said, pushed him away, he said, give me the bloody thing. And he jumped on it and this lad had put it in gear. When Stanley Clucas jumped on it and kicked it, it shot off towards the end of the jetty. We pictured he was going to go into the water in the dock. However, he put his foot down and swung it around. Next thing, he came flying at us, went past us, round the corner into this big warehouse, and there was a terrific crash. So we all ran. There was about four of us. We ran round to see what had happened, and there was a stack of timber and thin planks. Stanley Clucas had run into this and knocked this pile of timber down. He was lying there, the motor bike on its side, the engine running on all these thin planks all over him. His language for choice. He cursed everybody and everything to high heaven. And just at that time, Fred Hughes come walking round the corner. So we came up and asked what they cursed him worse than anyone. Eventually, Fred got the motorbike up and he took this message into headquarters at the Liver buildings. But Stanley Clucas, he was raving and ranting. I'll never forget that day. A few days after that, Pat O'Hare got married to Kathleen. And then, within a couple of days of that, we had messages to break camp and prepare to move. Well, the following day the regiment was marched off to the railway station. We had to march there and Pat and myself and two other gunners and a bombardier, we had to carry some cases containing battery accounts and orders, etc. So we took it in turns, the two men carrying the box, and the two marching behind with rifles. The bombardier led the way. So we arrived at Lime Street Station before the regiment. So we laid the box on the platform and mounted guard over it. As we mounted the guard, we saw Pat's wife, Kathleen, standing behind the barred gate. We were only a matter of a couple of yards away. And yet the bombardier wouldn't even let Pat talk to her. Now, one of these old soldiers, Stiffy Morgan, he happened to be one of the four men guarding these boxes. And he said to the bombardier, "You'd better find out which carriage this box has got to go to. And then we'd be able to go straight to it when the crowd arrive." And the bombardier fell for it. And he set off to find the guard. So Stiffy turned round to Pat. He says, "Go on, Pat. Now's your chance. We'll give you the wire when that old bastard comes back." Pat, he thanked us, and then he ran over to say his farewells to his wife. He didn't have many minutes, it wasn't long, but still, he did have a chance to say goodbye. It was a pitiful sight to see. She was crying her eyes out. They'd only been married 2 days. War's a cruel thing, isn't it? It brings tears and sorrow to the ones that are least concerned. Wasn't long after that the whole regiment arrived, and in a very short while everybody was on board wondering where we were going to. Then the train started hissing steam and it pulled out slowly out of the station. Pat was hanging out of the carriage window waving to his wife as we left. 6 hours later we arrived at our destination. It was a tiny village high up in the mountains of Lancashire, a place called Cark and Cartmel. It was pouring rain when we arrived there, and we had to march about 4 miles until we came to the camp. It was for gunnery training on the new Bofa guns, which the regiment was going to be supplied with. We'd seen pictures of these Bofa guns, anti-aircraft guns, but we'd never actually fired one or been close to one. When we used to do drill at the drill hall, we used to have orange boxes piled up and take our gun positions around the boxes, just pretending that we had a gun. So we were going to eventually now meet these guns and learn how to use them and fire them. This camp just looked like a tiny mushroom town. There were a couple of hundred bell tents under canvas. It had been raining, so we told, for the last fortnight, so you can imagine what the ground was like, all mucky and slippery. And it rained all the time we were there. It was a fortnight of pure hell. The rain never ceased. Most of the tents had wooden floorboards, but they still got mucky, and yet some of them had no floorboards. The gunnery practice had to be done in the rain, and when you were finished you were soaked through the skin and there was nowhere to dry the wet clothes. Then to get your meals you had to walk through a maze of tents to get to the big marquee where the mess tent was. There were quite a few of the men caught very bad colds, because it was by now, it was October. One of the ATS girls who was cooking for the troops, she contracted double pneumonia, from which she later died as a result of the conditions in that camp. She was the first casualty of the regiment. It was a tough fortnight of hardship, which the men took with the spirit of seasoned soldiers. The days just dragged by, it seemed like months. Then one day we got the order to break camp, and same night the regiment set off about 10 o'clock to march by the light of lanterns to the railway station. Those who could play mouth organs played the mouth organs, and everybody started singing to get your spirits up a bit. Singing the quartermaster's stores and guide me, thou the great Jehovah. There's a long, long trailer winding, and the beer barrel polka and all those sort of songs. It was a long, wet march with just lanterns to guide us away. So at last we got to the railway station, soaking wet. Actually, you had like a water ground sheet, rubberized ground sheet over your shoulders, but even so you got wet underneath. You couldn't help it. Amazingly, some of the villagers who turned up to see the two batteries off. Mind you, it wasn't hard to understand because quite a few of the boys had made acquaintances of the village girls. Then at midnight the train started and went puffing out into the darkness, taking the regiment on another mystery trip. Every man had the same thought in his head. Where till next? Eventually managed to doze off because we were all tired, bone tired with that fortnight hard training and discomfort, and fell asleep eventually. Then when morning broke, we woke up and we were discovered that there was only two carriages left on the train. In the night, whilst we'd been asleep, the other carriages had been disconnected and sent to different places. The regiment was split up and sent to different places in the south of England. We found that we were at a small place in Oxfordshire, a place called Bries Norton, or as the locals down there used to pronounce it, Bries Norton. The 41st Battery and HQ and one troop that was left. We were then marched off to a massive aerodrome which lay just outside this old English town. It was a big aerodrome at Bries Norton. It was the number 2 flight training station. 2FTS, Bries Norton. And it hadn't long been completed. There were long concrete avenues and streets with buildings and gardens on each side. It was just like a model village in its own rights. We were put in a long barrack room hut, holding about 20 men in each building. We each had a small little bed with a mattress and a shelf to put your things on, and a locker beside the bed. After the way we'd roughed it at that Cark and Cartmel camp, it just it was like being transferred to a soldier's paradise. And then we felt more certain that this was true when we marched to another big building which turned out to be a spotless dining room. And then when the breakfast came along, cornflakes and milk, bacon and egg, blimey, we were saying, we've joined the wrong regiments, boys. We should have joined the RAF. That made us feel a bit happier then. Then after breakfast, 8 gun teams were picked and we were sent to billets in different positions around the perimeter of the RAF station. The teams consisted of 6 men, each team manning 2 Lewis guns, an old First World War type of machine gun, which were mounted on wooden posts about 30 yards apart. And then we got billeted in barns and old farmhouses. Every morning, about an hour before sunrise, we were wakened up and had a bite of something to eat, and then we had to carry the guns and the ammunition about a mile from the billet to the gun site and stay there until an hour after sunset. there was a bell tent at the gun site where these wooden posts were, and we had an old small oil drums on three or four bricks and a supply of coke, which we used to put into this old oil drum with holes on the side, and then we lit it and made a fire to keep us warm. We used to cook a tin of beans or what have you on there, and boil your Dixies with some water in the Dixies to make a brew of tea. It was dreary and monotonous. Those who weren't actually on duty used to go and sit in the tent and have a smoke and yarn, while one man on sentry used to pace up with his rifles slung over his shoulder and walk up and down, keeping a lookout for airplanes, enemy aircraft. As I say, I used to sit round this brazier that make tea and toast. Sometimes we were lucky to snare a rabbit, which one of the lads had skinned and washed. Then they'd put a piece of wire right through it and cover the rabbit with butter, and then put it over a homemade spit and roast it. The boys seemed to like that, but I could never stomach it. I've never liked rabbit. But they used to say it tasted wonderful. It was under these conditions that we spent the long and cold and dreary winter. For a month or so there was quite a heavy snowfall, and it was a job to keep oneself warm. But you grew harder and stronger. The billet was a dirty place too. It was an old barn that we were in, and the only lights were storm lanterns, oil storm lanterns. That was the only means of illumination. There was a wall there with a big fireplace in it where we could get a good fire going. I used to sit there at night and play cards and what have you. Write letters home, and if you wanted you could walk along the road into the RAF station and go to the Naffy, where they had shows and a proper bar and proper canteen. Sometimes if it was a nice night, we used to take the walk, and it was about 4.5 miles. So occasionally we'd done that. At this gun site where I was stationed, there was Pud Dickinson, who went to school with me, and Tommy Blower, and the sergeant was a chap called, a big man called Jack Braby. But it was a cold spell there. So say it was a long walk, 4.5 miles, to get to the station, to the RAF aerodrome for the Naffy and what have you. But if you walked across the aerodrome, it was less than a mile. Now then, there were sentries all round the aerodrome, and it was out of bounds. But a couple of the lads had taken a chance and gone across on occasions and managed it. Anyway, this night I was short of writing paper. I was right out of writing paper, and nobody else had any that I could borrow, so I set off. It was a terrible night, wet, raining, and I set off and I was walking along. I had my steel helmet on because of the rain, and I had my ground sheet tape over my shoulders to keep as dry as possible. And I set up, and I got about halfway there. Then all of a sudden I put my foot out and I fell. And I fell down a great big hole. I couldn't make out what it was. And going as I was falling down, my tin helmet caught the side of the hole I was in, and I thought it was pulling my head off. I got in down the bottom and it was all wet and mucky, and I was dizzy. It was quite a shock, plus the jolt I'd got on my head, and I couldn't, difficult to get out, especially with the blackout and all that. My heart was pounding like a hammer. Anyway, I was there for a couple of hours before I could get out. When I eventually got out, my head was spinning, splitting headache, and I felt really rough, to be honest. I managed to make my way back to the billet without being seen. You had to be careful. I was waiting every now and again for a sentry to have spotted me in the moonlight and taken a shot at me. But I got back in anyway. I had to have a good wash down and hang my clothes up to dry, and I went to bed. Next morning I was still feeling pretty rough, and terrible pains in the head. So I vowed I wouldn't try that again. So the next day I managed to get a lift. Next evening I got a lift in an army truck, and I got some writing paper. And the night after that, I just had a letter from me mother and father, and I had another one from Joyce, and I was wanting to reply to them. So when we come off the gun site, I sat down. It was an old bit of a table in the billet, and I put the radio on, and was listening to some music. And this was the record I was listening to. I was thinking of home and my mother and Joyce. I'll have to get, as soon as I finish mother's letter, I'll write to you, Joyce. And my mind was wandering back to the last time I'd seen Joyce. It'd been 3 months since I had leave. And this music, Joyce, it was one of her favourite tunes. She told me about it. I'd often heard it played, but I'd never played it. In fact, I'd played it with Bert Ralph's, when I was with Bert Ralph's band, but I'd never thought much about it. But Joyce really loved it, and because she liked it, I started to like it, and it had a great effect on my life later on. Whenever I hear it, I always think of Joyce and me mother at the same time. Well, I was listening to this, my mind miles away and writing, when a lorry arrived from HQ. And the driver got out. His name was Jack Powell. He was a driver. I'd known him before I joined the Territorials. I'd known him quite a number of years. He said, I said, "What is it, Jack?" There was only Pud Dickinson in the room with me when Jack came. I said, "What is it, Jack?" He said, "I've just come from HQ." He said, "I've got some bad news for you, Arthur." So I said, "What is it?" He handed me a telegram. So my hands were trembling as I opened it. Couldn't think what it could be. Then as I opened it up and read it, it said, "Mother died suddenly. Try and get leave, Father." I was speechless. I'd just got this letter 2 days before from her, written by my mother. I can't believe it. He said, "I'm sorry, it's true, Arthur," he said. the major told me to come and pick you up, and they tell you to pack your gear and bring you in. He said he's arranging a leave pass for you, and you'll get the train from Oxford at 5:30. So I packed my gear, got everything ready, and I said cheerio to Pod, and then Jack helped me in the lorry, and we set off for HQ. He took me to the battery office, and the OC, Major Knife, and he'd been the one I was batman to in Liverpool on the docks when we first got called up. He told me that I was getting 7 days leave, which I was entitled to, and he had the warrant and some pay ready for me. So I thanked him very much, and I went outside and I looked around to see if I could see Pat O'Hare, but I couldn't find him. And someone said, oh, they heard that Pat had been transferred to another station. So I said to a cheerio, a couple of these lads who were there, and then Jack Powell drove me off in the lorry to the railway station. I had to wait a while till the train came in, but it was coming south. When it got in, who should walk out of the compartment but Pat O'Hare? Seeing me, he shouted, hello, where are you off to? So he walked up to me, and I said, my mother's died suddenly, I'm going home, Pat, for the funeral. He says, good God, he says, I'm just coming back from burying my mother. She died 10 days ago. I said, bloody hell, Pat. What's the war doing to us, eh? So I'd shattered him for a couple of minutes, and then the train whistle went, so I had to jump on the train and get the train and went off to Oxford. When I got to Oxford, I found I had to wait till 2:30 in the morning before I could get a train to Liverpool. That's why I had to go to catch the boat. I walked around the streets for hours. I couldn't get all it through my mind. I was flashing all the thoughts of my mother and all my childhood days, and laughing and singing. And times when she'd had to tell me off. All the sayings she used to come out with. We used to say, what do you want for your birthday, Mum? She used to say, a row of houses with a pub at each end. Where she got that from, I don't know. But she always said that. Whenever we asked her, what do you want for Christmas or what do you want for your birthday? She always used to say that. A row of houses with a pub at each end. And she often told me that her greatest wish was to have had a chip shop. Why, I don't know. I couldn't get all these thoughts out of my mind, thinking of her and thinking I'd never see her again. I cried my eyes out sitting on the railway platform when I got back there. Eventually the train came in, I got into the carriage. I sat by the window, I couldn't sleep. Got the train, got to Birkenhead at 8:30 in the morning, and then I had to cross the River Mersey on the ferry and got on the Isle of Man boat. And I sat up on the top deck there, away from everybody. And I sat there most of the journey home. When I got at Douglas, my father and brother Eric were there to meet me. Eric had a car then, so they took me home. The day after the funeral took place, apparently she died very, very suddenly. My sister Connie used to, she was working, as I mentioned before, at R.C. Kane's, the milliners in Duke Street, and she used to leave for work about 8:30 in the morning, and any messages that my mother wanted, Connie used to get for her in the lunch hour. And my mother was lying in bed. She hadn't been ill. She hadn't, but she used to lie in the morning and get up when Connie went to work, do the housework. So Connie was downstairs and she shouted up to her, "What messages do you want, Mum?" And she called down to her, some mincemeat, and told her two or three things she wanted. So Connie wrote them on a note, had her breakfast, finished her breakfast, washed the dishes, and she went upstairs to her bedroom for a coat or something, and just before she come downstairs, she looked in the bedroom to say cheerio to me mother, and when she looked in there, me mother was dead. That quickly. So she hadn't suffered, which was a blessing. I would have hated to think of her suffering and lingering. She had been troubled with cancer some years previously and had her breast amputated. But she'd always seemed to have got over that and always seemed to be happy. But that, remembering that funeral, driving to St. George's Church and then out to Braddon Cemetery. The grave was covered in flowers. She loved flowers. She'd have loved that. She really loved flowers, so her grave was absolutely covered. And she was buried in a grave next but one to her brother and his wife, her brother Jabez. Eventually made my way back home. All the days that followed, it's hard to explain them. How empty your house is when your mother's not there. How you miss her talking and pattering around the house, doing the 1,001 jobs that her lot. Chair she used to sit in. And she used to sit there, she used to knit and mend and seeing all the things that reminded her of me. And the funny thing, the dog Lucky, our little dog, he followed her everywhere and sat by her, laid by the side of her chair all day long. The day after my mother died, Lucky the dog died. I'm sure he'd... It's amazing why. I wondered why. Was it his love for me mother or what? But the morning after, they found him dead. He was such a pal and such a pet too. What a true saying it is that a boy's best friend is his mother. And that our love and devotion is never realised until it's too late. I didn't see much of Joyce that leave. Only a 3 or 4 occasions. I went on walks on my own. I couldn't get her in my mind. When I did see Joyce, she really understood and fell for me. She was a great consolation during that loss of mine. We once went to the theatre on that leave, and it was to the Gaiety Theatre. There was a repertory company on, and they were doing a stage performance of Smiling Through, an old drama. Amazing how these things come back to your mind. Even 7 days went over very quick, and the time came once again to say, so long, I'll be seeing you. How well I remember Joyce's words on the last night of that leave. She said to me, Bing, your mother's gone to a place where there is forever peace. No more will she have to worry. The war can't tear at the strings of her heart anymore. She will rest in peace until you see her again in heaven. Don't give up heart, Bing. Carry on and make the most of your life. Make those dreams of yours come true. She'll be watching over you from above. You can get to the top, I know you can. And I felt sure that your mother knew you could. Show everyone you can. And when you get there, and we are all proud of you, you'll feel that you've been a credit to all your mother's care and love. I'll never forget her saying that. So I set back off to Oxfordshire and Bryce Norton Aerodrome.